This is Anderson.
Okay.
I don't know if the Senate.
Well, that's kind of a.
You know what? That's a delete all he's got, amendment. Here he does. Good afternoon. We'll start the, we'll call the order of the Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee, Tuesday, February 23rd. Members, we don't quite have a quorum yet, and Senator Dames is the first up. First up with Senate File 1885. He does have a delete-all amendment. However, we won't have him offer that until we have enough numbers here so we have a quorum, but we can certainly discuss it at this time. So welcome to the you and your testifiers to the committee.
Mr. Chairs and members, I am here today to introduce Senate File number 185. And we do have a delete-all amendment, but we will go forward and we will pass that later when we get a quorum. Today with me I have Ray Bone from the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts and John Jasky, the Executive Director of the Bowser. And to give you a little background about this bill, about 2.5 years ago, a group started to get together, and this group was made up of a lot of local water folks, the Soil and Water Conservation District, and a lot of different watershed groups and water folks in the local counties. And they got together and started talking about what we could be doing in order to work better with our watershed and watershed management policy. And I believe that first meeting was in St. Cloud back in 2009. And today before us, we have the results of those meetings. And what Senate File 1885 is all about is it deals with watershed management policy. And it's a bill that looks at moving forward the watershed approach for the state's implementation of the comprehensive water management responsibilities. Some of the portions in this bill will deal with reform, which will be related to consolidation of water plans from over 200 to less than 100. We'll be looking at accelerating the science-based comprehensive management of water resources on a watershed basis, and also be looking at expanding and fostering local government partnerships for program delivery efficiency and effectiveness. Overall, the waters of our states have been a key aspect in Minnesota's vibrant past, and we need to be wise in production and use of our waters and make sure that we're very critical about how those waters are used in the future. And with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Ray for further explanations.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Bone. I'm here with the representing the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts and a couple of other local units of government as well. I drew the short straw, so I had to testify today. I also am representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts.
I really didn't realize that coming to our committee you'd have to draw a short straw, but
no, I have to admit, Mr. Chairman, you folks treat me pretty well, so I can't complain. Several years ago, the three organizations got together, got their leadership together, and decided that we had many common issues and that we really should start sitting down and talking about those at the leadership level. It was happening at the staff level, but the leadership obviously weren't involved. So we established what we call the Local Government Roundtable, and we've been meeting almost monthly since then. And one of the first things we did was we had the Water Summit, which Senator Dames just talked about. We had close to 400 officials there, local government officials, county commissioners. We had SWCD supervisors as well as watershed district managers. And a number of things came out of there, but the primary thing that we heard was, can't we do something to eliminate all these plans that are out there? And it seems like the counties were doing plans, the SWCD, were doing plans, the watershed district were doing plans. So we heard that loud and clear. So we've been working over the last 2 years to come up with a plan. And Bowser, by the way, has been facilitating our efforts and has been extremely helpful, and we appreciate that. So the bill that you have before you today represents the product of those 2.5 years of work. What we're trying to do and what we are going to be doing with this legislation is really make us a lot more efficient and effective because we're going to be working, planning together to begin with, and I think eventually we're also going to be working together on implementation of our joint plan. So, and it's going to be on a watershed basis, and you know, we have the MPCA, we have the DNR moving to watershed basis, so we clearly have to get there as well with our plans and working with Bowser. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to John Jaski, who is the director of Bowser, have him walk through the technical aspects of the bill, and I'm available for any questions you may have, as well as we have representatives from the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Anisolan Watershed Districts here as well.
Mr. Jaski, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, John Jaski, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. Senator Daines and Ray both described kind of a little bit of the background on this, and you know, the bill isn't all that long, but there's a lot of important pieces of it that allow us to bring together the existing plans that we currently have and move towards a comprehensive watershed plan. That won't happen overnight. It's going to take probably 3 to 10 years to work through that cycle, and that's okay because we're working on the assessments for water quality purposes at PCA is leading, and that is on a 10-year schedule as well. And certainly we've got local governments who have adopted plans that have been just recently prepared. We want to make sure those are utilized while they still have a useful life. And so it won't happen overnight, but we think this is going to set the stage for many decades ahead for a watershed approach to managing our water resources.
Jessica, can you talk to the makeup of the committee here and how that come about? And are there members, and if they're appointed, how are they appointed?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, yes. In the bill here, I want to mention that. There's a couple of housekeeping things. I would describe them early in the bill. It deals with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the members of that board that are appointed by the governor and that serve. And that's a little bit of the first part of this bill covers some of those housekeeping things. So I'll go into that first, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay with you then.
Sure.
The other part of the bill, beginning on Section 5, is where we started talking about the local watershed approach. The housekeeping items in here are on line 1.1. The Bowser Board, these are the members that are serving on that board. It's county commissioners, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and citizens, as well as members of the commissioner's office from the Department of Health, Agriculture, DNR, and PCA, as well as the University of Minnesota. And we also, a couple of years ago, the statute included the addition of a township member as well as two city officials. So we have a board that represents all of those various interests. One of the housekeeping items here on line 1.1 is that the citizen members who are you know, applying to serve and then are ultimately appointed, the way the current language reads is that it was a question that was placed to me about whether someone who was serving on a local library board or a park commission or something would be disqualified from service if they, in fact, were applying to be a citizen member of the board. And in the past, it hadn't been an issue, and it never had really come up. But when I looked at the statute more carefully, the Secretary of State said, well, one could read the statute to say that if you were on the library board, you'd have to resign your seat to serve as a citizen member of the Bowser Board, and that didn't seem to make a lot of sense. So this suggested change here is to make it clear that a local official or appointed official could serve as a citizen member of the Bowser Board, but a state official obviously could not. So that's the clarification that's being sought in that line. Continuing on then down in line 1.21 to 1.22, there is a requirement for a geographic distribution of the membership across the state. One of the holdover pieces of language from many years ago was that the Soil and Water Conservation District Association, their administrative boundaries were used as a, or currently are used as a way to assure that geographic distribution. However, because they're a non-government organization, they can change their boundaries at will and have recently done so. It hasn't really made an effect on the board members who are currently serving. But in the future, it could, and we believe that it makes sense just to have that holdover piece of language removed, and the geographic distribution will be accomplished by the language already in place under line 1.19. And it also deals with the metro versus urban, Greater Minnesota distinction on line 1.2. So that should take care of making sure we got representation from across the state. On bottom of page 1, line 1.33, 1.34, just making it clear that the way the board its decisions are carried forward is through orders of the board. Obviously, they make decisions, and that's the traditional way that the decisions are carried forward. That's not a change. It's just clarifying the statute. On line 2.3 to 2.4, We're suggesting that we add a provision to address any conflicts of interest that are actual or perceived. The board does make a lot of decisions which affect, the public, at large through local government actions primarily. And those bylaws that are in place do currently have this provision in them. We added that a couple of years ago, but we think it's helpful to have that in statute as a requirement for the long haul as well. And then on the bottom of, on the middle of page two, we have a statutory committee, one of several, but the only one that's named in statute that is set up to resolve disputes, primarily as an alternative to going to court. When the board added the city and township representatives a couple of years ago, this statute wasn't changed to reflect their ability to serve on this committee. So taking out the stricken language there allows the committee to also include all of the board members that are currently serving, regardless of who they're representing. And then it describes a process for adopting bylaws so that committee membership and duties can be chartered for all to see and know about.
Mr. Jassy, I'd like to stop you for a second and just recognize that we do have a quorum present now, so for the record. Thank you. Please continue. Senator Dames, would you like to move the amendment so we can get into it?
I would like to move the A2 amendment, the delete all amendment.
Senator Dames moves to amend Senate file number 1885, a delete everything amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman,
continue, thank you.
With that, I will go from the housekeeping items into the real content of this bill, which is beginning in the middle of page 2 on line 2.16. As Senator Dames mentioned, what we're asking this legislation to accomplish over this 3 to 10 year period is to allow the plans that are currently in place and developed and owned individually by counties, soil and water conservation districts, or watershed districts to be able to substitute from one another, so we don't have to have three plans. We can perhaps get by with, over time two and then ultimately one plan for the entire watershed. So during this transition period, we need to have these plans have the ability to serve as substitutes for one another to work through the transition. And then we also are saying that as an option, sometime during that transition period, they would move to this comprehensive watershed management plan. And that term is first used in line 2.2, and later we have a definition that's created for that. The two key words in there are comprehensive, so that it covers all aspects of water management. It deals with water quality, with flooding, with habitat, to some extent with groundwater perhaps, where it interacts with the surface, potentially with supply issues. But it, by and large, it covers the gamut of water management factors because we have to manage it as a system. And the other part in there is that it's a watershed plan. And in your materials that were handed to you, there's a map of Minnesota that shows the delineation of the watershed scale that is being suggested that we use. This has been very commonly used and accepted over the number of years previous. Ray mentioned that the state agencies are going towards a watershed approach. These watersheds are not something you'd know if you crossed one necessarily driving in your car, but clearly we can delineate these boundaries using topography primarily as the primary means. There's also gauging stations that are established at many of the outlets of these watersheds, so we can get good information. On the back of this map, it lists those watersheds by name. Obviously, Minnesota has some square lines around the edges of it, too, and we have watersheds that are partly in Minnesota and some that are partly in neighboring states, and we'll need to deal with some flexibility about how we organize Minnesota's approach in those little partial watersheds. You can see, for example, down in the southeast, we got a couple, 46 and 47, which are really just small parts of watersheds that are primarily in Iowa. Minnesota is blessed with the ability to mostly deal with our water leaving the state, not having to receive water from other states. We've got the headwaters of three major continental divides, the Mississippi, the Hudson Bay drainage, and the Great Lakes drainage. But we still have those boundary issues that we'll have to work through, and there's a process in the legislation to deal with that. In the bottom of page two, it charges the agency with working with stakeholders and others to develop recommendations, and including some of these issues that are perhaps going to be tied to the boundaries for these plans. This is similar language that we've used in other endeavors, including the drainage responsibilities that we oversee. Work groups have been very successful in working towards consensus, and I think this bill actually reflects it. The fact that 2.5 years of work has led to a bill that most everyone believes is a better way forward, rather than trying to hurry up and do things quickly. We do them systematically, and we get a result that will be sustainable. The bottom of page 2, you'll see here for the first time the term TMDL and the reference to Chapter 114D. That is the Clean Water Legacy Act of Minnesota, which was passed, I believe it was in 2006, and it deals with the water quality responsibilities that the state and the federal government through the Clean Water Act and passing it on to the state responsible agencies, the PCA being the principal one. There's a connection there so that the water quality plans that are being prepared based on that assessments will become part of these local plans as well.
I could just interrupt 1 second. One of the things that was important to us in that whole process and the TMDL, Mr. Chairman, was that we wanted that to be permissive because we really do want to work off of the local priorities. And we're obviously very willing to work with PCA and MPCA on the TMDL implementation when and where it works. But if it doesn't work, we want to have the ability to maybe work on our own priorities as well.
Okay. Members, any questions so far?
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue then on top of page 3. This is where we get at the process for determining these boundaries because, as I just mentioned, they aren't something that you can – they're not. We're replacing county lines, as everyone knows where those boundaries are, with a natural landscape feature, which is the watershed line. Obviously, those are distinguishable, but, not something that people are going to know without first finding it. And so we have a process for identifying where those boundaries are. Watersheds, although they're scientifically determined – there's still some bit of judgment about how they're combined or separated. You can always make them smaller. You can also make them bigger. You can see even on this map, we see the basin scale watersheds for the Red River, the Mississippi, et cetera, the Rainy Lake. That's a scale that's, in our belief, much too large for a real concerted planning effort, an action-oriented plan that will result in people locally understanding and supporting it. So we believe that the 81 watersheds that are identified on this map are about the right scale for doing this kind of work. But if there is a discrepancy among the local governments about where the boundary should be, there's a process for them to bring that to Bowser and get a decision. If they don't like the decision, they can appeal that decision through the court process, or they also have the option of going through a mediation process that we would facilitate and hopefully get to a conclusion on. With that, I will move on to page 3. We're taking out some language on the bottom of page 3, which will be replaced later on, allowing some extension of plans because we do need some flexibility with plans that are currently in place so that we can allow them to be stitched together on a watershed basis as they come close to their due date, and extensions might be needed in certain cases. That language on extensions is put back in there on page 4 from line 4.12 to 4.15. At the top of page 4, we have this term, this Comprehensive Watershed Management Plan, which would be the replacement plan for all the others ultimately, and it would encompass, as I described, a comprehensive approach and a watershed basis. So that would be a pretty straightforward definition to cover all of those things that would be in one of those plans, including, as Ray described, water quality issues, but as well as flood control and other water management responsibilities. Page 4 at the bottom, we're incorporating all that same language. We have to put all of these terms in here because they all are currently in place with the idea that over this transition period of 3 to 10 years, we would move towards a singular plan on a watershed basis. Middle of page 5, we're taking out some prescriptive language that is dating back from 1986 when counties were given the responsibility for managing water in some way, shape, or form. They had a responsibility to establish a separate dedicated levy. Counties have said and have shown, actually, that they've got other ways that they can accomplish that same match requirement, and we believe that taking this prescriptive levy requirement out is very helpful to them, and they've still got the responsibility to match the funds the state provides to their endeavors. On the middle of page 5, the new language there is focusing on a performance-based granting mechanism that the agency would use to award state funds to these local water management authorities. I should mention, too, that one of the things that we had to make sure we sustained in this language was the ability of the existing organizations to use their their own financing mechanisms, their own authorities, their own sovereignty, if you will, as they currently do, but stitch it together when it was important or necessary or advantageous to put it together on a watershed approach. So this language preserves all of that. And then in the top of page 6, we have a few bits of description about what kinds of things would be considered to be performance-based criteria for the state providing funding in cost-share fashion to the local water management authorities. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members, that's the conclusion of the bill.
Mr. Chair, that concludes the presentation. We'll open up for any questions.
Members, any questions? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jashke, I was just wondering, I'm looking at the map here, I wonder if you submitted this to the special redistricting court. This could have worked out for us.
Jashke, I was going to ask that same question when you're talking about county boundaries. It kind of looks like it might have been, yeah.
I'm assuming, Senator Gerlach, I guess it's not unfathomable that someday you may have districts that are on a watershed basis, but I think it's a ways off. We'll get to the planning part of this first, and then we'll figure out if that's still worth considering.
All right. I wonder if my district would get smaller.
I think so. Senator Scoy, did you have a question? I'm sorry. Okay. Any questions, members, of Mr. Jasky or Mr. Bowen?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate file number 1885 be moved for possible inclusion in the policy bill. Be laid over and included.
Any?
Here he has amended.
As amended.
Yes.
Any questions, members?
I mentioned the governor.
Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, thank you, Mr. Senator Dames. Next, Senator Peterson, Senate file 1860.
Mr. Chair, it may have been mentioned before I came, but puts us with Tuesday, the 23rd.
Oh, I know,
Tuesday.
I'm sure.
Is it Tuesday?
This Tuesday, the 23rd.
Okay, we'll go along with that amendment. What day is it? I don't know.
Thursday.
Thank you, Senator. I might have even actually said that, so for the record, let's clear it up. It is Thursday, actually. I might have read it off of there, too.
It's Thursday.
It's what?
It's Thursday.
Thursday, okay. All right. Senator Peterson. You've got some folks with you. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today, before we have you, Senate File 1860. It's a bill that relates to highway construction, allowing a special slurry disposal provision in certain highway construction improvement or repair contracts, proposing coding for a new law in Minnesota, this chapter 161. We have before you today, I have some guests here that are really experts in this field and can talk to you about the process. I should note that if I recall correctly, this bill came out of the Transportation Committee with unanimous support if it came to environment with some concerns that were raised there, and you'll hear some other testimony relating to that in the near future. But at this point, I'd like to turn the testimony over to my guests to talk about the process as you consider this proposal.
Thank you. Mr. Kramer, is that correct?
That's correct.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Terry Kramer. I'm owner and president of a company called Diamond Surface Incorporated. Have been for the past 23 years. Diamond Surface is a highway maintenance company specializing in diamond grinding, concrete repairs, and installation of rumble strips. Our office is located in Rogers, Minnesota, and we have a shop and manufacturing facility in Big Lake, Minnesota. We also manufacture the specialized equipment we use in our work, as well as build equipment for other contractors. DSI has 52 full-time employees, and during the construction season, that number can grow to 100. There are three diamond grinding contractors located in Minnesota. The three of us represent the three largest in the industry, Diamond Surface being the smallest of those three contractors. During the peak season, the combination of them three companies employ 400 to 500 people nationwide. Diamond grinding is a technique of using closely spaced diamond tip blades to plane the surface of a given roadway. The concept is very similar to planing a piece of wood. If the wood's too rough, you plane it down to make it smooth. We do the same thing to the road surface, particularly concrete surfaces. The benefits of diamond grinding are many, but most importantly, the process restores rideability. The rideability relates to how smooth the road feels when you drive it. The smoother the road is, the longer it lasts. It also restores friction. Better and higher the friction is on the pavement surface, the safer the surface is to drive on, the less likely there are accidents to occur.
Mr. Kramer, does it also wear our tires out a little bit quicker?
There's no documented evidence of that.
Thank you.
And thirdly, noise reduction. This is something that's just come about in the last few years. Tire pavement noise is getting to be a bigger and bigger issue. The quieter you can make the surface of the road, the cheaper or potentially cheaper it is to mitigate noise, especially in the urban areas. There are studies that indicate you could possibly reduce the height of noise walls or in some cases eliminate noise walls. The process of diamond grinding is very cost competitive and is generally from $2 to $3 per square yard of roadway. That was prior to the new slurry rules.
I'm sorry, could you quote those prices again?
Typically, you're going to see prices $2 to $3 per square yard. There's 7,020 square yards in a lane mile of roadway, so about $14,000 a lane mile for diamond grinding.
Thank you.
A lot of the other fixes that would produce similar results can be 2 to 5 times higher than that. So it's a very competitive way to keep the road surface in good shape. The durability of a diamond ground surface has been proven to last, and this durability has been documented in research conducted by Caltrans, which states that a diamond ground surface will last as long as 16 or 17 years. In terms of providing a safer surface, in research conducted by Marquette University, a dry road surface that has been diamond ground will have 40% fewer accidents. A wet road surface that has been diamond ground will have 57% fewer accidents. So the numbers really speak for themselves. This is a good technique, and it's very cost-effective. It's also worth noting that diamond grinding doesn't require any new natural resources, such as aggregates and cements and asphalts and whatever they happen to be building the road surface out of. As I stated earlier, diamond grinding is a process of using diamond tip cutting blades to plane the surface of the road. In that process, cutting the road surface, we use plain water to cool and lubricate the cutting head. The combination of the cooling water and the roadway or removed roadway surface creates a byproduct called slurry. In the past, we've been allowed to deposit the slurry on the vegetated inslopes of the roadway. In areas where there was not a vegetated slope to deposit the slurry on, such as a city street or an urban area, the slurry was loaded into a tanker and then hauled away to a disposal site. In some cases, we are allowed to truck the slurry to a rural location and spread the slurry on a vegetated inslope. As the specifications stand now, all the material has to be loaded into tanker trucks and hauled off the project. There are no exceptions. Material has to be hauled to a disposal area. The disposal area has to be constructed for each job if they're not close enough where you could tie a few jobs together. The area receiving the slurry has to be lined and then dewatered. The remaining solids have to be loaded and hauled to a landfill once the dewatering process is complete. These requirements have dramatically increased the cost of our operation, and in my mind do not provide any benefit to the taxpayers of Minnesota. The increase in cost is a moving target, but generally we will see our costs increase per square yard from 50 to 100%. There's a lot of variables that determine that. The conclusions from all testing and research completed on slurry from around the country indicates there are no harmful effects from depositing slurry on the inslopes of our roadways. In all the previous years that we were allowed to deposit slurry on the inslopes in Minnesota, I cannot recall one incident where there was an environmental issue. In many of our neighboring states, such as Wisconsin, North and South Dakota, slurry can still be placed on the inslopes of the roadway, as well as many other states. And to name a few, Montana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas are states that we work in as a company, and we've been allowed to still place the slurry on the inslope there. This issue is crippling our industry in Minnesota. We most likely have already lost projects because of it, and it will continue to cost us projects in the future. The long and short of these rules, or these new slurry rules, are is they provide no benefit to any of us, but they certainly add a lot of cost to the work we do, and already budgets are tight and money to fix highways is very limited. So that's why I'm here. I'm asking you to consider this new legislation.
Okay. Question, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, is there any reason why that slurry isn't just put on the shoulder and kind of mixed in with the gravel instead? Could you explain why the process is the way it is? It just seemed like the shoulder would be.
Mr. Kramer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The slurry is generally deposited in the grassy section of the inslope rather than right at the gravel shoulder. Why would we not want to put it right on the gravel shoulder? There is no reason why we couldn't put it there, but generally we put it right into the grass. That acted as a filter for the slurry as it was deposited.
Follow-up question? So is it fair to believe maybe the substance coming out on the shoulder might wear the shoulder or might, erode the shoulder? What kind of force would be coming out of that?
If it was a gravel shoulder, it might tend to wash the shoulder as you're depositing it on there. There are pictures in the best management practices that's contained in your folders. And you can see there the way we discharge the slurry. It's the picture on the third page in the upper right-hand corner. We drag a hose along in the grass. Basically, you don't really see what's going on there except that we're depositing the slurry in the grass. If we were depositing on the gravel shoulder and it happened to be a fairly loose material, we would probably cause some erosion of that shoulder.
Mr. Kramer, you said maybe for the members to take them through this process. You put out bids from MnDOT or counties to, and they're gonna want you to shave down a certain area, sort of high spots on the road. Or is it strictly being done for public safety areas?
It's done for both those reasons. If you've all driven down a concrete pavement, it sounds like you're running down a stair steps. That's a problem in the concrete pavement that it develops over time. It's called faulty. When we grind it, we're getting rid of that faulting and smoothing the road back out, which extends the life of the pavement. And as well as doing that, we may be grinding it to increase that friction that I talked about earlier. There are certain instances where you don't have a lot of roughness, but the aggregate in the concrete gets polished, and they'll grind it to restore the friction. But really, when we grind, we have to meet a ride specification. In other words, when we get done grinding, we have to measure it with a device that tells us how smooth we got it. If we don't hit a certain number, we have to regrind it. The benefits that you get from grinding happen whenever we have to meet that ride spec. They're incidental to the ride specification being met. So you get a good ride, you get the smoothness, and you get the reduction in noise. But typically, MnDOT would spec grinding if they were trying to improve the rideability or the smoothness.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, it sounds like that would be a really efficient way to do that restoration, too, like much faster than if we were trying to overlay and do all of that sort of thing.
Mr. Kramer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The nice thing about it is we can do it at night, return the traffic back to it in the morning. We can do it during the day, open the lane closures up for the full roadway to be used at night. It's not like we're adding 2 or 3 or 4 inches to the road surface. So there are a lot of benefits that way as well. We can, on average, grind between 1 and 1.5 lane miles in a 10-hour shift. That's about the speed that it moves.
Mr. Kramer, are you familiar with the cutting diagonally across the concrete, fresh construction concrete? Are you familiar with that diamond cutting, and what happens to the slurry there? I think that just simply gets washed out because of, isn't that a cooling system that uses for those blades?
Yeah, when they're building a new concrete pavement, they have to green saw
right.
The construction joints, the transverse joints. That slurry, as I understand it now, has to be contained as well.
Okay.
Well, I apologize. It does not.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Dames.
Mr. Kramer, the slurry that you're putting in the ditch, does that dry up, or does it get hard, or does it turn into a granular like sand? What happens to it after it's there?
When we
Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. When we deposit the slurry in the, on the inslope there, generally within the same day it dries, and it gets crusty, but it doesn't get hard like concrete again. It's basically like the gravel that we took off the road.
Any questions? Otherwise, we'll turn to the next witness, Mr. Peterson, Senator Peterson. Mr. Zeller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Zeller. I'm the Executive Director of the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota. I've been at the Paving Association for a little over 10 years now. The 10 years before that, I was with the DOT in their concrete office and oversaw a large portion of the concrete paving work done around the state. I just was going to go over, we handed out a folder to all of you, and inside there's a handful of different documents that support our issue here. The first one on the right side that Mr. Kramer referenced is the Diamond Grinding Slurry Handling Best Management Practices. And I won't go over this in detail, but again, you can see on there where, you know, the biggest questions we get is, how was this slurry deposited? And as Terry mentioned, up in the upper right-hand corner of that third page, you can see it going into the vegetation. On the top of that same page, you can see a couple of different machines working in tandem and how we stagger those deposits so we don't put one on top of the other and overload the shoulders or the ditches. And again, you can look through that. It talks about best ways to handle this and the way industry would prefer to go forward as far as handling this in the future. The other document on the right-hand side of your folder was a specification from MnDOT in the highlighted part at the second paragraph from the bottom is the only reference we ever had to diamond grinding slurry in the past. Essentially, it said the residue and excess water resulting from this operation shall be removed from the roadway by vacuuming. Residue and water shall not be permitted in either flow in across the lanes of traffic or flow into gutters or other drainage facilities. Essentially, we could put it in the ditch as long as we didn't put it in any water streams or a storm sewer system. On your right-hand side is a handful, or left-hand side, excuse me, are is a handful of documents that are research-based information. The front art document is from a magazine article summarizing a study done by North Dakota State University in the Journal of Environmental Quality. Again, there's a long report that goes with this. This is the summary report from the magazine, but if you look at the back page, there's some highlighted conclusions. Second statement under those conclusions reads, while direct depositation of concrete grinding residue machine product on the vegetated parts of highway rights-of-way may be unsightly to some, the environmental impact is negligible. The next paragraph down below it talks about changes in the aggregate composition could alter this in the future. In recent years, fly ash and other non-traditional materials have been introduced into concrete mixes. And in the Transportation Committee hearing, Senator Dibble asked about that. And the samples that were taken for this off of I-94 did include, actually, I went back and looked it up in MnDOT records, did include fly ash. And again, as far as the NDSU study went, there were no detrimental effects from having fly ash in the concrete and then having that concrete ground. Behind that, again, is another industry summary of that NDSU study. It goes into some of the the way industry sees things. Next document in there is from New York State Department of Transportation or Department of Environmental Conservation. Again, the backside highlighted essentially says that diamond grinding slurry is not, in their view, an environmental problem. And the last one I wanted to bring to your attention was from Caltrans, California DOT. And this was done quite a while ago, actually, 1997. And you should have a flag page, which will bring you to their conclusions. And was the 1, 2, 3, 4, fourth bullet below. Says the 96-hour acute toxicity testing showed no toxicity characteristics for the slurry samples as manufactured by the 100% survival rate of the fish test. Essentially, they took this diamond grinding slurry and dumped it in a pond. And it looked pretty extreme for California, but they did it, and all the fish lived, and nothing came out with two heads. And the last item behind there is, again, is a general chemical composition of diamond grinding slurry. And with that, I will be more than happy to answer any questions if you have any for us.
Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you both. Maybe you want to hang close. We're going to have Mr. Kadelka from the MPCA, I believe, wanted to give testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name for the record is Kirk Kadelka. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And thank you for the opportunity to comment on the bill. Since the bill's introduction, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and MnDOT have been working together to look into this issue. And we've had a number of discussions and have shared them with the author and the industry. Looking through this, that it was because of EPA guidance that PCA and MnDOT requirements had changed. We have now reviewed some of the information they provided to us, the industry. We've also made some calls to neighboring states and are right now sharing between the two agencies language that would carve out in the definition of solid waste, concrete slurry, if it's used in the best management with BMPs to be developed. And so this is something we're still sharing with language. We think it's something that we can all get to where we need to be on. And we'll be sharing with, once the MPCA and MnDOT are fine with the language, we'll be sharing it with other folks too, and we'll continue to move forward on this avenue.
How soon before this information sharing is going to be accomplished?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we could have it in a couple of days to get some language for folks, for legislative language to review.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kadelka. So you would see no reason for us not to move this bill along and keep it going with the understanding that you're probably going to get there before this bill would be finally passed on the floor?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we believe we can get to a place where this will be a bill in the right shape for everyone. What the committee decides to do, whether hold over for an omnibus bill or move it on its own, we'll leave that up to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kadelka.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, we have had that discussion, and of course, the industry and our office is certainly interested in seeing the language before we would make any commitment to add it at this point. And that's what the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has agreed to let us see it before we would move it forward, and they're willing to accommodate that because of their quick response. And to that point, I really need to compliment the agency in their response to this issue. They have worked very swiftly and given this issue immediate attention in order to keep this process moving forward.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Peterson, I'm sorry, I just arrived from elsewhere, so maybe you've gone over this, but I'm trying to figure out the special provisions that are the pieces of the special provision. And the bill says that it must include language requiring removal of the slurry by vacuuming, and then requiring the deposit of the slurry on the inslope. And that those seem to be two opposite things. You either take it away or you deposit it and on the inslope. And so I'm wondering if there should be an or between the two of those, or whether I don't know enough about, you know, the diamond grinding thing and making the slurry to know the difference, but is it actually two different processes that they have to do, or is it one or the other?
Mr. Kramer could probably answer that.
I bet he could. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The grinding machine itself has an onboard vacuum system, and we use that vacuum system to collect the slurry up so we don't have it running all over the roadway and getting into the open lane of traffic. And as it passes through that vacuum system, then it goes through a process of separating the air from the liquid, and the liquid is pumped off to the shoulder of the road from the grinding machine itself.
So it's a mechanical thing she's talking about, or the question.
That's correct.
The process. So, okay.
Thank you.
I have a question from PCA. I think they explained what we do with it now. They take it out to a landfill, and it goes into a does it go into a matted area and is covered? Or exact? Can you tell me how that works?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I would not probably be the best person to answer that question. I don't know how they do the disposal on the end. The industry might be better to answer that question on how they handle it currently.
Sure. We like our committee because we give our witnesses a lot of exercise. Thank you, Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we do now is we basically dig a retention pond as close as we can to the job site, and then that retention pond is lined with the fabric, and then the slurry is deposited in there, and then we dewater the slurry, get the water out of it, and the solids have to be loaded up and trucked away.
So that's your responsibility, and that's part of the bidding process, and you have the site. It's not a public landfill or anything like that you're hauling it off to.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Any questions, members? Okay. Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and members, our desire here now, the agreement we have is just to hold this over till next Tuesday, if you have a spot for us in the committee, and then at that point we should have the language by then, and ask that we would move the bill at that point if we have.
Okay, we'll just hold it over. Temporarily hold it over. Senate file 1859. I'm sorry, Senate file 1860 will be temporarily held over till the following committee meeting. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill is Senate file 1859. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator John Carlson. This bill was brought to me by one of my constituents. Evidently, last year when we passed the SSTS delay in rulemaking, we inadvertently left behind the tank manufacturers and the folks that put the tanks in the ground and some of the rules that that affect their business. I believe that was an oversight. It was inadvertent. And what I'd like to do is have Mr. Gary Whippler here explain what that means to his business that we made that goof. So with that, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Mr. Whippler.
Mr. Whippler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'm Gary Whippler, Pine River, Minnesota, precast tank manufacturer. We do approximately 300 to 400 tanks a year. Small business, currently have 2 employees. Mr. Chairman, the impact of the rules, as stated, if I'm not in compliance by April 4th, I would probably have to turn over the keys to my business, and because we've been down economically for 3 years with the construction industry, probably the keys to my house too. I've been doing everything I can to comply. There's some provisions in the rules that I don't agree with, and we don't, after much discussion, we don't seem to be able to come up with the reasoning behind some of the rules. I believe I've been manufacturing for 11 years. I believe my tanks, as they sit, we've always been a progressive company. We listen to the installers, the pumpers, and the things that make sense economically for my customer and for the consumer. We're making a quality product right now. Our tanks go in the ground generally 2 to 4 feet deep. Occasionally we approach 6 feet deep. It's probably the exception to the rule. I believe some of the requirements that are in the rule right now are going to be hard to meet. The consumer is going to end up paying additional money because we're not going to be able to inventory 2 or 3 different styles of tanks, a light, medium, and a heavy tank based on the value of the inventory. If you've got 100 tanks sitting in the yard, you may have $100,000 to $120,000 in value in the inventory. If you double the different doubled your inventory, it may end up being twice that. So,
Mr. Whipler, does this Senate file Senator Carlson is carrying help you out a lot? Then, in other words, it's good for your industry.
It's good for the state of Minnesota. It's good for Mr. Chairman. It's good for the industry. It's good for the consumer. I believe my tank in everyday use is better than what they want me to change my tank to.
Okay. Members, any questions? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, what do they want you to change, and what's going on with your tanks?
Some of the construction, Mr. Chairman, some of the construction techniques as far as the head space, the baffle height in the tank, the liquid level in my tank isn't sufficient to get the 9 inches of head space that they need or they desire. So my tank can be passed by adding a filter to it. There's some questions that have not been answered by the PCA. I've got a customer on the Whitefish Chain who will put in three tanks on one lake lot. And the way the rules are written, I would have to install three filters in those, one in each tank per system. We've been putting in filters for 8 years. We're progressive. We're ahead of the schedule. We do well with what we're doing. They couldn't answer me whether I needed to put in one filter or three filters. A filter basically costs my customer $50 because I don't have the required 9 inches of head space. I would have to install a filter. That puts me at a $50 competitive disadvantage immediately, and on one of my customers, it would be $150 higher. There's baffle height. There's insulation. We've got septic tanks that are freezing up there right now. The PCA, because of the heat that they receive from the Iowa border, the installers down there that have never seen crushed ice in a tank, they've changed the rules to state that only the top of the lid needs to be insulated now. We had our own spray foam rig 4 years ago, and we were spray foaming tanks halfway down. 9 inches of head space puts your liquid level down at that 42-inch level. Foam across the top of the tank isn't going to do the Iowa border any good. It's not going to do northern Minnesota any good. And we had it licked at halfway down the tank. It's down at the liquid level where it needs to stay warm. They've changed it now, so we can't. It doesn't make sense economically to spray foam a tank. Three sheets of foam is anywhere from $60 to $80. We were spray foaming halfway down our tanks and delivering it to our customer for $225. I was making $40 on that. It was good for the customer.
Any further questions? Otherwise, we do have somebody from the League of Minnesota Cities. I believe Mr. Johnson, would you like to testify?
Great, thank you.
I'm sorry, Senator Carlson first.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to have Mr. Right. Johnson come up. Yep.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just briefly spoke with Senator Carlson before the bill came up, and as we were looking at it, I think it has an unintended consequence, and it sounds that way from speaking with the author. The way the language works right now, in lines from the no at the end of line 1.12 through the end of the new language, it says that if, until a county has adopted the 2008 version of rules, no version of those, including final amendments, shall be effective within the county. Under 115.55 subdivision 2A, cities and townships are allowed to have their own ordinances. The rest of the county must be affected by the universal county ordinance. This would actually say that existing city and township ordinances that may have components of the new rules would no longer be in effect. They would be stricken down by this change for all subsurface treatment system ordinances that they have. I don't believe that's the intent. We certainly have a number of communities that have decided they need more stringent standards in place than the baseline state standards for their community and have worked very hard to implement them. And I'm I don't believe it's the intent to cause those communities to undo those in cities and towns that have their own ordinances. I do have language I can work on, Mr. Chair, before this bill is finished. We could work with the author to get that fixed up so that it doesn't have any unintended effect.
Is this something that can be handled right now?
Mr.
Knopf has actually got his pen in hand. He's working over here in the corner.
Mr. Chair, I have a suggestion if it works for Mr. Knopf, that after the period on the new language of line 1.14, a sentence could be inserted that says, a city or town may still exercise their authority to adopt and enforce ordinances under 115.55 subdivision 2A. And that language currently, Mr. Chair, simply says county ordinances must apply to all areas of the county other than cities and towns that have adopted ordinances that comply with this section and are as strict as the applicable county ordinance. So we can't be less restrictive. We have to be at least as.
Senator Carlson.
I would move that oral amendment by Mr. Johnson.
I think we'll have it repeated by Mr. Knopf here so everybody understands it.
Mr. Chair, I think just to be clear, though, we should put something at the beginning that says prior to county adoption, a city or town may still exercise to adopt or enforce their ordinances.
Mr. Chair and members, I would never question the drafting advice of Mr. Knopf.
Really?
No, sir.
I'm sorry, repeat it again, Senator Higgins. Prior to.
Mr. Chair, the first sentence in this talks about county adoption. So what I've got is at the beginning, kind of the sentence that would be following it after the period on line 1.14, it'd be prior to county adoption, comma, a city or town may still exercise to adopt or enforce their ordinances.
May adopt two of them. May adopt. I'm getting hung up in that may adopt something there.
Exercise their authority, maybe? Or?
It's just exercise their authority to adopt. I think, okay.
Or to authorize and enforce?
Mr. Chair, the frequent phrase that we use in these is adopt and enforce because it's related to ordinances.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think we've got a new and improved one here.
The new and improved version for Mr. Knopf.
Prior to the county adoption, a city or town may still exercise their authority to adopt and enforce their ordinances.
Only, Mr. Chair, the there should be its because it's singular, yeah, city or town.
Good point.
It's like grammar day.
Boy, it's Senator Higgins' grammar day today. There's no question. And we really appreciate that. You want to repeat it one more time? I'm sorry, Senator Carlson?
But before you do that, Mr. Knopf, is it possible that we need to add pursuant to? Or I don't know. I know you're the expert.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we need to. I think it's pretty clear that this is all the section is talking about. And you'll see up in the top, notwithstanding 115.55 subdivision 2. We know we're dealing with subsurface sewage treatment systems here. I think that'd be okay.
So we are down to the final draft, Mr. Knopf.
Prior to county adoption, a city or town may, and I don't think we need the word still in there, may exercise their authority, it should be its authority to adopt and enforce its ordinance. So both places we use the word its instead of there.
Senator Carlson.
Move that amendment.
Okay. Members, any questions? Hearing none, the amendment that was offered by, clarified and written by Mr. Knopf and now offered by Senator Carlson. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. Members, any further questions? Kirk, I guess, from the MPCA, Mr. Kadelka would like to testify. Welcome again.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Again, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We do have some concerns with the bill that we've mentioned to the author previously. The bill as written is very very broad. I know the concerns raised today are dealing with the tank verification deadline on April 4th of this year. However, there are a number of deadlines already in the rules. Many of them have passed already, dealing with installers training and along with registered products. This language would reopen up those deadlines for those situations. In addition, the way this is drafted, there are 35 counties that have already adopted the standards. So this would not change anything in those counties for tank manufacturers. They would have to meet the April 4th deadline, which would create, depending on what county you're selling into, you may or may not have to be on the verified list. But overall, we do have some concerns with this length of a delay out to 2014 of our tank verification rules. Prior to the 2008 rule, septic tanks had a general water tightness and strength requirements, but not very, not a way of verification. And so in the 2008 rules for septic tanks, we added clarity and certainty to these requirements by adding details in a verification process, and those details were a performance standard. The reason MPCA did this was because of environmental concerns. We've heard of many cases with leaking or cracked tanks, poor seals, improper attached baffles from counties, SSTS professionals, and our own staff, and some in the manufacturing industry. And that is part of the reason why a number of concrete tank manufacturers supported the new standard and the creation of these verification requirements in the new rules. The idea is to build better tanks across the industry to provide increased public health and environmental benefits. Other areas of the building codes also have various standards and testing and verification of their products. And so what we're looking at right now is a deadline for verification of tank manufacturers' products is April 4th of this year, which is not connected to the county's adopting local standards. That's something that's strictly with the state. And there are two ways to verify tanks are up to code. One is signing off from a professional engineer, and others the product testing and verification. And since late 2004, the MPCA has publicized these changes that will be needed for companies to verify their tanks, including webcast meetings, notices in public trade publications, attending conferences, and other techniques. And the way our staff actually collected the list of folks to contact is by going through phone books across the state to find out who are making these tanks. So we did try to go the extra mile to make sure we are alerting everyone to these changes. And we have also now stepped out our outreach, making calls into each of those folks we have in our list. We have a list of about 55 or so companies, and we've been making calls to check in on how they're doing. A number of early adopters within the manufacturing community are also willing to share their testing procedures that they've used to make the verification. Companies in Wilmer, Rosemont, and Stewartville, all of them have gone through this already and are sharing those techniques with other companies. The industry is trying to help its other members. And as mentioned, the PCA is increasing our outreach and also customer service to help manufacturers meet the deadline, to answer questions, to help them with the paperwork, the applications, and any questions they may have. To date, we have 7 manufacturers that have verified their tanks. We have 26 that are in the process of doing so, and 19 manufacturers have been contacted, and we haven't seen any paperwork yet. And 5 companies we still have calls out to, we're not quite sure if they're making tanks or not. So as you can see, a large number of the industry is already moving to meet this deadline. And so as heard today, we've heard from one side of the industry with some concerns of whether they can meet the verification deadline on April 4th. We've also heard from the other side, those early adopters who are concerned, and both of them express concerns about a possible extension cite economic losses to their business. Those who are still have to meet the deadline, and those who have met the deadline already and have gone through the process and now have followed the rules, and other companies will be able to sell their tanks while they've done what was needed to make the verification. So the MPCA has been listening to a number of folks. We've heard from legislators and other companies, and we've come up with a potential idea on how to handle this situation. What we're looking to do is make a soft, floating the idea out right now to make a soft deadline about an extension. So by April 4th of 2012, manufacturers would at least have to have in their tank drawings for all their models to the MPCA. And then before August 1st of 2012, manufacturers would have to have all their testing and final drawings and related verification paperwork into the MPCA. This would allow for installers to, excuse me, and then we would still require installers to be responsible for choosing a tank that have verified if it's available in their area. And if it's not during that time before October 1st, it would be more than available to use other technologies. So what we're not asking folks to do, if the early, if those who have adopted it, say there's not someone in the International Falls area that's adopted, we're not asking them to ship in a tank from the cities or somewhere else that may have the verified product during this soft deadline time. This is a technique we used with the earlier registered product deadline in 2010 that worked very effectively, allowed manufacturers some additional time to move forward, and also meet the requirements and the rules without having to extend it out numerous years. This is something we're still looking at, and we appreciate this hearing today is to hear from various folks, and including hearing feedback from the legislature on if this is a good idea to move forward with. With that, I'll conclude my comments and ask for any questions you may have.
Members, any questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate. I've always had a great working relationship with Mr. Kadelka, and he's so nice to work with. And I was happy that he came up with this proposed solution. The thing that would be really would really be helpful if we had that sort of in writing, so that as we move forward, there's some relief for some of these manufacturers that they know that that's not just, well, we said that, but now we're going to take it back. And that's not to, I just, there needs to be a level of certainty for this business to go on and move on in their business. They're coming up on their season very shortly, coming up on the deadline very shortly. And so there needs to be some comfort that they wouldn't have a rug pulled out from under them. And I'm not suggesting that Mr. Kadelka and the MPCA would do that. We need to give them some comfort there.
Well, Senator, I think it seems like the MPCA is certainly willing to do that and come forward with something. But, however, I do agree that that's all fine and dandy, but I think we have to move this forward in order to make that happen. And Mr. Kadelka, are you telling me that if we move this forward, that you'll be able to get this probably worked out in the next within the next week or so?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're floating this idea. We've had floated this idea to a number of manufacturers and others through one-on-one conversations, but we did want to use this opportunity to float it out to a wider audience to get feedback on also to see if this is something that folks would be interested in. I think as an agency, we also have a concern of extension of deadlines moving out beyond. I mean, if there is the agreement that October 1st is the correct extension of the deadline, will we be back another year and extend it another time? I think that's why we're looking for some feedback from individuals and also the legislature on whether this does sound like a good idea.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I think what I would like to do at this point is move Senate File 1859 as amended to be recommended to pass for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Environment Policy Bill, with the understanding that we can get this worked out with MPCA and make it work for the manufacturers, that we can pull it and it wouldn't be in there and there'll be peace in the valley.
Very good. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried. Very good. Thank you. Members, I have nothing else before the committee. The committee stands adjourned.
I was sick of the exam.